Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated July 19th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's front page news, top of the fold, Downtown Raleigh Hotel to get a new owner, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is from Raleigh. The Raleigh City Council has given its blessing to the developers of the Marriott City Center Hotel in downtown Raleigh to sell the building, which was built with the help of $20 million in public money. New York real estate firm Cary Watermark Investors is under contract to purchase the hotel by the end of August, confirms Mitesh Shah, CEO of Noble Investment Group in Atlanta, the firm that financed and built the hotel in 2008, primarily to provide lodging support for the $220 million Raleigh Convention Center that opened the same year. Shah would not disclose how much Cary Watermark has offered to pay for the 400-room property. Industry sources say it could fetch around $60 million, or about $150,000 per room. But Wake County taxpayers won't participate in any profits from the sale. That's because the $20 million from the county's local hotel-motel prepared food tax was offered as a grant in exchange for a promise to hold at least 80% of the hotel rooms open for bookings attached to the convention center. Shaw says most of the tax funds were used to construct the hotel's 15,000 square feet of meeting rooms, connector spaces to an underground tunnel to the convention center across the street, and for the hotel's infrastructure. Shaw claims about $50 million came from private investors when the hotel was built 5 years ago. Raleigh Assistant City Manager Dan Howell says that, technically, the city owns those public spaces financed by the tax grant, but the hotel's management team is in charge of operating the meeting space and keeps any revenue generated from those spaces. We don't gain any benefit from the sale of the rest of the building, Howell says. The city will still own the 2 acres of land where the hotel sits, and the new owner of the hotel will still be required to make good on Noble's $75,000 per year ground lease payment and any other elements of agreements Noble has made with the city since 2004. The city's agreement with Noble also offers the company a half-rate rent rate on 200 parking spaces in the city's parking deck beneath the hotel and City Plaza for hotel guests. Shaw says he believes the arrangement has worked out well for both Noble Investments and for the city. The reality is, it's been a phenomenal success story, he says. Hal says representatives of Cary Watermark have indicated the firm plans to invest between $10 million and $15 million in improvements to the hotel over the next 5 years. They've offered that to us without us even having to ask the question, he says. We hope we will have a partner that will be at least as good as, if not better, than Noble. A representative of Cary Watermark Investors did not respond to requests for comment. Cary Watermark is a non-traded real estate investment trust that specializes in lodging assets. It is a joint partnership led by real estate investment firms W.P. Cary Incorporated of New York and Watermark Capital Partners, LLC of Chicago. This week's lead story on the cover, Clustering Clean Tech in the Triangle. Marcus Wilhelm with Strata Solar is on industry's cutting edge. This article is by Chris Bagley and was written from Raleigh. Companies that focus on new types and efficient uses of energy have grown precipitously in the last decade into a cluster of related industries that employ more than 6,000 people in the Triangle. With that growth, while likely to continue, faces hurdles and is likely to come in fits and starts. And that could pose a challenge to economic developers who pitch the region to multinational companies that might set up shop here. Collectively known as clean tech companies, they span a range of industries and include those whose software management whose software manages Electricity Flow, utility meter manufacturers and developers of solar farms, as well as developers of water filtration systems. The reason they are growing are just as varied, but many have to do with a growing awareness of humans' impact on the environment. Many of the companies owe their growth to improving technologies that reduce both environmental impact and energy costs. But their growth is also tied to specific governmental policies, in many cases, a double-edged sword. That became clear in 2012 when utilities ran out of the federal money they'd been using to upgrade meters at customers' locations and responded by laying off 5% to 15% of their local employees, a total of 100 to 115 people. In April, a legislative proposal to roll back North Carolina's renewable energy quotas drew significant support before ultimately washing up in a House of Representatives committee. Uncertainty over tax and regulatory policy was one reason that such companies' statewide employment grew by only about 3% in 2012, after 10% growth in 2011, the North Carolina Sustainability Energy Association said in releasing those estimates. Some of the fastest-growing clean tech companies are solar developers, whose projects make use of tax credits. Those projects include a 100-megawatt solar farm that Chapel Hill's Strata Solar is planning to begin in Duplin County by the end of the year. CEO Marcus Wilhelm says it involves $250 million in investment and will probably involve as many as 400 workers. The clean tech cluster extends beyond energy, but its single largest source of growth in the next 20 years is expected to be utilities spending to upgrade their aging grids with equipment and software that limits electricity waste and accommodates alternative generation from solar farms. The rub is that while virtually everyone in the utilities industry agree on that need, the companies invest as they're allowed to pass the spending along to customers. That's determined by regulators in most states. There's a whole lot of stuff that ebbs and flows with the whims of the regulators, said Ed White, a former engineer at Westinghouse Electric who founded a metering software company and later sold it to Itron Incorporated. White chairs the Research Triangle Clean Tech Cluster, whose member companies include White's field-to-base software company, Duke Energy, Cisco Systems, and the European electrical conglomerates Schneider Electric and ABB. Many of those companies have annual revenue in the billions of dollars. Their wide range of business lines means they don't depend heavily on one set of regulations. The industry that's built up over time here is solid, stable, and growing, says Alan Burchett, ABB's Region Function Manager for North America Strategic Initiatives. The company employs a total of nearly 700 people in Raleigh and Cary and hundreds more near Rocky Mount. Still, several large companies have specific business units headquartered in and around Raleigh. The effects of a regulation can show up more clearly in a particular business unit. Depending on how the terms defined, clean energy companies have about 500 locations in the area and employ 6,000 to 8,000 people. There's no precise employment count available at the local level, but the Triangle is home to about 35% of such companies in the state, including some of the largest. An annual survey by the NCSEA counted more than 15,200 statewide in October. White's company and the 10 others set up by the cluster organization last year, in part to help in recruiting employees. While unemployment seems stuck in the 9% range statewide, it's below 8% in the Triangle. And executives say larger clean tech companies' growth depends on filling new positions as they open up. That said, upstart companies face challenges in signing on first customers even after proving their new technologies, Burchett said. That stage is nicknamed the Valley of Death because it lies between initial funding for an exciting technology and the time when revenue begins to cover costs, and it's particularly important for clean tech startups, Burchett says. ABB has set up a sort of venture funding arm to take minority stakes in such companies, aiming to help bridge that gap in the hope that they'll one day become strategic partners. VCs, or venture capitalists, have soured on this new term, clean tech, Burchett says. Strategic investors have not soured on it. Rob DeSalt, A top manager at Schneider's facility in Knightdale says his company has benefited both from the formal cluster organization and from the proximity to other companies and NC State University engineers. This gives us not only technical insights for our industrial customers, DeSalt says, it also provides us with a pool of candidates. There's a timeline for the clean tech industry that can be traced back to 1953 and 1954, when Westinghouse Electric moved its metering operations to Raleigh. The company wasn't focused specifically on clean technology, but the Triangle's growing pool of technical know-how helped Westinghouse spin off a series of smaller companies built on energy efficiency. Companies that serve gas and water utilities have benefited from similar know-how in the Triangle. Starting in 1954, Westinghouse Electric moves its electricity meter division's headquarters to Raleigh from Newark, New Jersey. In September 1972, Schneider Electric opens its first Research Triangle facility in Knightdale. In 1978, Siemens AG and Alice Chalmers form a joint venture to develop electrical control equipment. 1980 brings former Westinghouse engineer Ed White to start Utility Transitions Systems, which develops software for remote meter reading. In 1989, the European power equipment conglomerate ABB buys Westinghouse's transmission and distribution division, including its metering business in Raleigh. A road near Capitol Boulevard still bears the Westinghouse name. 1991 sees ABB moving local operations onto NC State's Centennial campus, becoming its first corporate tenant, while in 1966, White sells UTS to Itron, a smart meter company whose largest locations are in Washington State and Raleigh, North Carolina. 2002 finds ABB selling its metering division, headquartered on South Rogers Lane, to a German metering company. It is now known as Elster Solutions. In 2004, two private equity companies buy Investis PLC's gas metering business, which had a major presence in Raleigh. 2009, ABB moves its North American regional headquarters to Raleigh from Norwalk, Connecticut. And in November 2012, the Eaton Corporation acquires Cooper Industries, which had a large facility in Apex. The move gave Eaton, one of the world's large power management companies, a larger presence in the Triangle. And in July of 2013, Schneider Electric announces plans to acquire Investis PLC, which is now mainly a building controls company, for $5 billion. Moving inside the front cover, this article by Lauren K. Onisorge is entitled, With Move, PsyQuest States Intent to Keep Growing. If all goes according to plan, CFO Rudy Howard projects employee count will rise from 251 to 340. This article comes to you from Morrisville. In signing a lease that will shift its headquarters from Cary to Morrisville, software firm PsyQuest is betting big on growth. The as-yet-to-be-built office space, the majority chunk of Duke Realty's planned Perimeter Park 2 building in Morrisville, is 78,565 square feet. Compare that to the current space of 61,000 square feet. CFO Rudy Howard says the company is quickly outgrowing its current digs. The decision to move, he says, is keyed by PsyQuest's plans to continue the growth trend. That's the hope, he says. Hopefully our business will continue to grow as it has over the past several years, and we continue to execute from that perspective. Currently, the Cary location houses 251 employees. Howard predicts that if all goes according to plan, that number could reach 340 by this time next year. Anytime you enter into this large of a commitment, you spend a lot of time on it, he says, detailing the lease decision that was nearly a year in the making. It kind of starts with putting together and reviewing alternate plans of where you want to be from a headcount perspective. PsyQuest software is designed to help companies manage their spending, inventory, and accounts payable with a goal of cutting costs. Richard Davis, analyst with Canaccord Genuity, says the timing is right to take that growth bet for a variety of reasons. What they're trying to do basically is help organizations save money in their procurement, he says, adding that historically clients primarily have been state and local governments as well as educational institutions. With sequestration and other cuts looming, SyQwest and companies like it could provide the cost-cutting answers, he says. It just makes things more efficient, he says, to the software. You're not having to lay anyone off. You're not having to cut programs. But the biggest reason SyQwest can grow? Because it's still a fairly small business market, share-wise, Davis points out. And with SAP's recent acquisition of procurement giant Ariba, it might be time to steal some of the market. Research firm Gartner predicts the procurement software market, a subset of the spend management market, will grow at 10% a year to $4 billion in 2016. SyQwest, he adds, is inching its way into corporate procurement, traditionally Ariba's domain. What they're planning on is that the fact that Ariba has been acquired by SAP, and sometimes when that happens, the acquired company loses focus, he says. That creates an opportunity to take market share from those guys. But there are several factors at play, cautions Howard. That's where strategy comes in. While institutions might see the benefit of spend management software, they don't always have the funding to invest in it, he says. A lot of the challenge is in timing. Do they have the investment dollars to spend presently? Do they have the resources to devote to implementation? Are there IT resources tied up in other projects, he asks, all questions that can make or break a deal. Additionally, SyQwest has to evangelize not just about its products, but about the spend management industry. It's not a mature market, he says. A lot of these entities continue to find out about our product. The deal itself is big news, regardless, for Duke Realty, which had already procured minority tenants such as MaxPoint Interactive and Fujifilm Medical Systems. SyQwest is the home run Duke Realty Senior Vice President Jeff Sheehan had been waiting for. The building is scheduled for completion on August 1, 2014. SyQwest annual minimum rent payments will start at $1.15 million for the first year of lease and increase annually to $2.15 million in the 10th and final contracted year. And now, Amanda Hoyle, who covers real estate and residential real estate, has an article titled Sizing Up McCrory's Picks for the Economic Development Team. Governor Pat McCrory this week announced his choices for 22 appointees to the State Economic Development Board, a group charged with establishing policies and strategic planning initiatives for economic and community development in the state. The new chairman, Charlotte businessman John Lasseter, led his first meeting of the board on July 17th. With an overhaul of the state's economic development system pending under McCrory's direction, it's unclear whether these appointees will remain in place when a new board is established under what the governor is calling a partnership for prosperity. Probably so, given that these are his choices. So here's a look at what the newly appointed members from the Triangle bring to the table in economic development. Not in alphabetical order, first in line is Jim Whitehurst from Red Hat. Jim Whitehurst, president and CEO of Red Hat, who serves as vice chair of the board in 2010, sat on the other side of the table from Commerce Department recruiters, where he and his board members were trying to decide whether to stay and expand in Raleigh or relocate. Whitehurst is on record saying that North Carolina almost lost the deal because Georgia and Texas were willing to offer better incentives. The Tar Heel State's offer turned out to be enough. Red Hat was awarded up to $15 million in state grants. Next on the list is John Kane Sr. of Kane Realty Corporation. John Kane Sr., chairman and CEO of Kane Realty Corporation in Raleigh, is known best for his success in the redevelopment of North Hills, the retail office, residential, and entertainment complex that has become a powerhouse in what's being called Midtown. Kane has recruited new restaurant brands, new investors, and new companies to his buildings since the project started in 2001. Kane will serve as a county economic development representative on the board. Next in line is Madhu Berriwal from IEM. Madhu Berriwal, president and CEO of global emergency services contractor IEM, is the only holdover from the previous administration's appointments to the Economic Development Board. Barawal relocated her company to Durham in 2010 from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, after negotiating up to $9.3 million in state and local incentives from North Carolina recruiters. Following is Chuck Swoboda of Cree Incorporated. Chuck Swoboda, Chairman, President, and CEO of Cree Incorporated in Durham, has helped build Cree into one of the largest homegrown technology companies in the region through the development, manufacturing, and sales of its energy-efficient LED lights around the globe. Cree, in 2010, was awarded $4.4 million in local and state incentives to expand its headquarters and to build a new production line for silicon carbide wafers in Durham. Following is Fred Smith of the Fred Smith Company. Fred Smith, the founder and namesake of the Fred Smith Company construction and residential development firm in Clayton, is also a three-term state senator who relinquished his seat to run for governor in 2008. Smith came in second to McCrory in the Republican primary, but quickly threw his support behind McCrory's campaign. McCrory lost that election to Democrat Beverly Perdue, but didn't win the governor's seat in 2012. Last on this week's list is Tom Looney of Lenovo. Tom Looney, Vice President and General Manager of Lenovo's North American operations, is known as a sales leader and has helped grow the Chinese computer company's market share since its acquisition of IBM's personal computer business in 2005. Lenovo, which has its U.S. headquarters in Morrisville, was awarded $11 million in state and local incentives to keep and grow its PC business in the Triangle, but the company never collected on the grants. And that is the sizing up of McCrory's picks for the Economic Development Team for North Carolina. This week's column on healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business by Jason DeBrun has an article entitled Duke's Hospital Gets Stellar Ranking in Publication's Annual List of Best. Duke University Medical Center ranks as the best hospital in North Carolina and one of the best in the nation, according to the latest U.S. News and World Report hospital rankings. Elsewhere in the state, only Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center ranked close to Duke. The hospital in Winston-Salem was nationally ranked in 12 specialties, only one behind Duke. Nationally, only 3% of all hospitals earn a national ranking in any specialty. U.S. News and World Report's annual ranking of best hospitals has been produced each year since 2005 by the Social, Statistical, and Environmental Sciences Division of RTI International, a research nonprofit headquartered in Research Triangle Park. The rankings are sometimes criticized because a significant portion of its methodology relies on subjective measures like a hospital's reputation or results from surveys. Here's how U.S. News and World Report ranked the hospitals in the Triangle and the number of nationally ranked or high-performing specialties. State rankings are also listed. First rank, and also in the first rank in the state, is Duke University Medical Center with 13 ranked specialties and two of the high-performing specialties, which are not listed. Second is the University of North Carolina Hospitals, third ranked in the state, three ranked national specialties, and eight high-performing specialties. Third rank and in the nation and fourth in the state is Duke Regional Hospital, with one of the nationally ranked specialties and nine of high-performing specialties. Fourth ranked nationally and fifth in the state, Wake Med Health and Hospitals has zero nationally ranked specialties and nine high-performing specialties. Ranked fifth nationally is Rex Healthcare, eighth in the state, with zero nationally ranked specialties and eight high-performing specialties. Last on the list, number six in nationally and 16th in the state is Duke Raleigh Hospital, which has no nationally ranked specialties and only four of the high-performing specialties. This information comes from the U.S. News and World Report. Jason DeBrun also includes a cost of health care Duke style. Duke University Health System proposed a $48 million renovation at the Duke North Hospital building. The renovation would not expand on any of Duke's regulated assets like hospital beds or operating rooms. Crews would upgrade utilities for a better patient experience and renovate 9 operating rooms and a 16-bed cardiac critical care unit. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services requires a projection of revenue when submitting expansion or renovation projects for approval. Listed are selected projected financials for the hospital system. I'm sorry, but currently those listings are not available. Continuing with the hospital listing stories, North Carolina restrictive on nurse duties. North Carolina ranks as one of the most restrictive states in terms of regulation on nurse practitioners, a practice that some believe contributes to a higher health care cost. Using Texas as a model, economist Ray Perryman estimates immediate savings of $16 billion in the healthcare market by reducing restrictions on tasks that can be performed by nurse practitioners and other advanced practice nurses. Locally, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina President Brad Wilson has long said he wants to see healthcare providers practice at the top of their abilities. What follows are some recent enrollment trends for nurses in the University of North Carolina system. Since 2007 and 8, overall enrollment in bachelor's, master's, and doctoral nursing programs has grown from 4,636 to 5,724, an increase in 31%. In the same year measured, the total degrees conferred for each year by nursing graduates at all levels increased from 2,022 to 2,330. A growth of 15%. And in 2012, a total of 1,036 UNC nursing program students took the nursing exam for the first time and 94% passed. This week's column from Lauren K. Onisorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. This article is entitled Aiming for Lasers to Zero in on Cancers. Professor brings research to Duke from Princeton. The world is starting to pay attention to Duke University's Dr. Warren S. Warren. Warren, who moved to the Triangle in 2005 after a stint at Princeton University, knows lasers. His work is focused on developing technology to better control the beams. And when he realized where his interest was leaning towards medical applications, he knew he needed to find a program with a medical school. That's what brought Warren and his lab to Durham, where he has been working on a laser that he hopes can help doctors differentiate aggressive from non-aggressive forms of melanoma. It's an application that has nabbed more than $1 million in funding, but it's not the reason his laser research made national media this summer. A few years ago, we were in London on vacation, he says, adding that he was looking at a museum exhibit of art forgeries. I walked out of it realizing that the art community was using technology that was 20 or 30 or 40 years old. In my position, I see a lot of the cutting-edge biomedical imaging technology. I thought, what if you started using those technologies on some of these cultural heritage issues? He now has formed partnerships with institutions including the National Gallery and the North Carolina Museum of Art. Paintings are actually designed in many ways so that they mimic skin in order to be realistic, Warren explains, describing how the greats such as Leonardo da Vinci painted 30 layers on their masterpieces. The same solution that works for skin turns out to be a really nice solution that works for artwork. Dr. Warren assumed that just as with skin lesions, yellowed varnish and paint layers could be imaged by his laser to distinguish original paint from restoration, helping us understand the intended beauty of centuries-old paintings, says William Brown, chief conservator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. But while Warren has assigned one of his team of 20 to the art application and is developing a grant-funded handheld laser device that museum professionals can use on site, the primary function of the lab is the melanoma work. In 3 to 5 years, he hopes his science is ready for human trials. Funding has come from the National Institutes of Health. The rate at which people have been dying of melanoma has gone up about 8%, he says. And for patients not to have scars from all the biopsies would be wonderful, quotes Dr. Craig Burkhart, a UNC Chapel Hill dermatology professor. And then there's a huge disparity in the diagnosis, which has gone up about 150%, he adds. Our tools for diagnosing really aren't that good, says Warren. The majority of melanomas, he says, can essentially be cured by excising the mole and surrounding tissue. But the minority, they can be a death sentence. What's the difference? Well, that's the rub. The mole has to be removed and tested before doctors know what they're dealing with. Warren hopes that his imaging lasers can chemically tell the difference between aggressive and non-aggressive cancers sooner, meaning aggressive treatment can start quicker. UNC Chapel Hill dermatology professor and clinician Dr. Craig Burkhart has another point. If he knew melanomas were not going to be as aggressive, the excision could be smaller, he points out, leading to less scarring. Currently, mole depth is one of the indicators of aggression, he says, as is how fast the mole is proliferating. For patients not to have scars from all the biopsies would be wonderful, Burkhart says. The technology is currently in the clinic at Duke University, but only with already excised moles. Warren hopes one day to be able to use the laser on a patient without surgery, a move that could lessen scars and patient impact. Next up, bid farewell to Hub as Incubator Space becomes HQ Raleigh. Hub Raleigh is officially no more, but before you panic, know that it's just a name change. The entrepreneurial workspace will now be called HQ Raleigh, a decision made after a month-long rebranding discussion in which Hub watchers were allowed to vote on a new name for the space, which currently houses the likes of bridal-themed app developer Wedpix. Co-founder and entrepreneur Brooks Bell says the name serves as a reminder of the broader mission of the space, to advance Raleigh into one of the top five cities for entrepreneurship in the next 5 years. Next up, Spotlight on Banking and Finance. The study offers a census of state's investment sector by Lee Weisbecker. This article is from Chapel Hill. North Carolina's investment management industries, concentrated in the Triangle and Charlotte, continued growing after 2008 despite the impact of the financial meltdown and recession. In fact, total employment in the industry grew by 31% to nearly 77,600 during the period from 2005 to 2012, according to a new study from UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School. Led by Professor Gregory W. Brown, the study breaks ground in its effort to define investment management as a unified sector and to measure the impact of that sector on the larger North Carolina economy. As the study points out, it's an industry with a lot of moving parts, encompassing everything from retail stockbrokers to investment advisors, and includes portfolio managers, investment bankers, third-party fund administrators, and pension, trust, and estate overseers. There is a wide gap between what some of these players do. Even so, says Chapel Hill, Chuck's Leedy, founder of Chapel Hill Investment Advisors, as an intellectual exercise, Brown's approach holds water. On the whole, I think it's valid, says Leedy. By adding up all the wide-ranging industry categories, Brown and his colleagues, Andrew Cooper and Colby Isabel, identified 3,192 investment management or IM establishments across the state. About a third are stock brokerages, employing 5,493 investment professionals, up 37% since 2005. Firms specializing in offering investment advice also make up about a third of 3,000-plus IM establishments. By 2012, those companies employed 2,744 investment professionals, up by 80% since 2005. The average pay in the industry in North Carolina is $129,832, three times the state average, but 41% below the national average for IM jobs. This gap is likely attributable to several factors, including a lower cost of living in North Carolina relative to major financial centers, a relatively young workforce, and a larger proportion of lower skill and wage jobs within particular sub-industries, the professor says by way of explanation. Brown also enlisted the help of the North Carolina Department of Commerce to perform economic modeling that helps chart the extended impact of the IM industry. Among the conclusions are, 1, The state's 3,192 IM establishments provide direct employment for 21,047 investment professionals and a supporting cast of 56,543 others. The resulting total of 77,590 are the industry's so-called direct jobs. Two, what then happens when these people spend money for goods and services results in a further boost to the economy that in turn creates an additional 64,050 indirect jobs, the modelers concluded. And three, adding direct and indirect together yields a grand total of 141,640 jobs, or 2.7% of total state employment. The investment management industry in North Carolina is large and growing, the study concludes, with optimism high for its continued growth prospects over the next 3 years. Continuing in the spotlight of banking and finance, the next article is entitled Crowdfunders Believe Rules Give Them a Break, by Kent Bernard, Jr. New rules issued by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission have the operators of crowdfunding sites giddy that startups will be able to say flat out they're raising money. But not everyone's a fan, and some warn the rules set to go into effect in 60 days could open the way to fraud. The SEC on Wednesday took the first step toward lifting an 80-year-old ban on general solicitation for investment by private companies, hedge funds, and private equity and venture capital shops. The action was required by the Jobs Act passed by Congress last year. So far, only accredited investors can put money into startups. But the SEC is working on rules that would open the field further to anyone who wants to invest. As to the rules issued Wednesday, Alejandro Cremades, chief executive of New York crowdfunding platform Rock the Post, told me they're a great first step towards opening up funding to startups. Startups have been handcuffed for the last 80 years, he said. One of the things that we are most excited about, we feel that now these startups will be able to use tools such as social media, and that is going to bring more transparency. This is huge for startups. But not everyone's a fan. Angel investor Malcolm Handelsman told the Pittsburgh Business Times the new rules could actually cause more problems for both investors and startups. In a perfect world, this is great for investors and entrepreneurs, said Malcolm Handelsman, a retail entrepreneur turned angel investor. The bill brings us into the 21st century of communication, and each constituency will have a greater opportunity to connect with and help each other. Unfortunately, we live in an imperfect world, and I'm afraid that, in the short term, fraud will become prevalent as both unscrupulous investors and entrepreneurs will try to take advantage of the system. There have to be safeguards to protect both parties and everyone. Professional angel investors and professionally advised entrepreneurs will proceed cautiously and understand that this new law will simply expand their reach and the pool of companies and investors. I'm afraid that it is the naive, uninformed, accredited investor and the entrepreneurs looking for a quick fix that will suffer and be taken advantage of. End quote. Cremades acknowledges that there's plenty of risk associated with startups advertising for funding, but he said sites like his offer the opportunity for investors to vet startups carefully. People go to the casinos every year and spend over $49 billion without any limitations, he says. Only time will tell. People will be able to operate in a very safe environment. Ryan Caldbeck, the chief executive of CircleUp, a crowdfunding site for consumer goods and service companies, told me, quote, the opportunity now exists for the market to function more efficiently, and it reduces lost time on both sides. We can help these consumer and retail companies connect with their passionate brand advocates outside the CircleUp platform, which is really exciting for us, he says, end quote. The author of this article, Mr. Bernard Jr., is the money and finance editor for the Upstart Business Journal, a Triangle Business Journal sister publication. Next up, Landmines Ahead Could Blunt Growth of Sector, by Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. The Triangle's clean tech cluster of companies has grown swiftly in several recent years. Can it continue at that pace, despite shifting agendas on Jones Street and Capitol Hill? The factors influencing the cluster's growth are as varied as its companies, but many have to do with decisions by government agencies. Here are a few. 1. Will Congress and President Obama renew the federal tax credit for renewable energy systems? Individual taxpayers can claim tax credits of up to 30% for investments in residential projects like rooftop solar panels. Cost of these systems have fallen amid progressing technologies, but people in the industry say most projects still depend on the credit, which is scheduled to expire in 2016. Morrisville Southern Energy Management and numerous smaller companies focus on such projects. 2. Will the North Carolina General Assembly keep the state's renewable energy portfolio standards? A 2007 law mandates that most electric utilities eventually derive 7.5% of their electricity from solar, wind, and other renewable energies. A senior legislature has pushed for its repeal, saying that the cost of the program fall on ratepayers. Will he take up the cause again in 2014? Chapel Hill's Strata Solar has scaled up its projects to a point where CEO Marcus Wilhelm says it could survive without the REPS requirements. The company is now planning a 100-megawatt solar farm in Duplin County. But people in the industry say companies with projects in the range of 1 to 5 megawatts would be at risk. And 3. Exactly how speedily will utilities invest in their grids? Duke Energy and other utilities have recently embarked on a massive wave of infrastructure spending that's likely to last at least a decade. But how quickly will the money flow? Billion-dollar grid investments can pay off for both electric utilities and their customers in terms of efficiency savings, but the companies often time their decisions around their ability to pass the investment spending along to consumers, and that ability is controlled by regulators. Moreover, high electricity rates can dampen job creation across the economy, even if they let utilities that produce, say, electrical equipment and metering software. This week's guest opinion column is from Mr. Blake Zalkberg, who is the Chief Executive Officer at OFM, an office and school furniture manufacturer, distributor, and wholesaler with headquarters in Holly Springs. He's entitled his column, Open Office Space, Not for Everyone. There's no doubt about it, the open office is the hottest trend in the American workplace. From Manhattan to Silicon Valley, even well-established businesses want to borrow a little of that startup mentality with open workstations and shared space. But it's not right for everybody. Some departments and businesses simply can't work in an open office environment, nor should they try. The open office is good about encouraging creativity and collaboration by tearing down walls and/or cubicles that can keep workers feeling disconnected. That kind of design is great for some businesses, but it doesn't work for everyone. Not every wall should be torn down. In fact, some are crucial to helping a business function properly, protecting valuable client information, and even following the law. Consider the Human Resources Department. Employees need to feel comfortable discussing sensitive topics like medical leave, sexual harassment, or even termination when meeting with a Human Resources staffer. That usually means a private office with a door that can be closed. Payroll and accounting are also other sensitive areas. Some employees have access to highly sensitive information about how much people are paid, not to mention the financial situations of clients and customers. That often means not just a door that can be closed, but locked, too. In some workplaces, everyone's job involves sensitive information and conversations that need to be private. Consider firms that handle Wall Street trades, national security contractors, clinics that test for various diseases, and most lawyers. And then, of course, there is the noise factor. Some companies' work requires a lot of concentration without any distraction, which an open office layout can often hinder. And it's something that many employees struggle with. This, in turn, can affect productivity. Recent studies even go as far as to show the types of employees that work best in open office environments, with introverted types performing poorly and extroverted employees faring best. Regardless of what size company you are or the type of work you do, it's important to consider whether an open office layout is the right fit. Just because it's the latest trend doesn't mean it's the right move for your workplace. And if it's not, it doesn't mean your business will be left behind. This week's guest opinion column is from Mr. John Hood, who is the president of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. He's entitled his column, Tax Reform Package, A Good Start to Tackle Tar Heel State's Fiscal Health. North Carolina is about to implement the most sweeping state-level tax reform in recent American history. Not surprisingly, the Republican-crafted tax bill has provoked passionate responses. Some liberals complain it will rob state government of the revenue it needs to finance schools, roads, and other valuable assets. Some conservatives complain it doesn't go far enough in expanding the sales tax to fund dramatic reduction or even elimination of income taxes. The passage of tax reform may be historic, but that's no reason for either side to become histrionic. What really happened is that North Carolina just took a long overdue first step towards fundamental tax reform. It is empirically sound, fiscally prudent, and economically beneficial. Admittedly, if you see inadequate government revenue as the main problem with North Carolina's tax code, you should be disappointed. But your view isn't shared by the new Republican majority or most voters. They properly see inadequate growth in the private economy as the main problem. The GOP tax bill is a reasonable response to it. Keep in mind that Governor Pat McCrory and the General Assembly don't see tax reform as a panacea. They know that other policy variables matter too. That's why they have also adopted a new transportation funding system, pursued a series of regulatory reforms to encourage business starts and expansions, and sought structural changes to the state's education system. For sustained economic growth, the name of the game is investment, building and deploying capital to make work more productive, which in turn leads to greater income and job growth. Liberals are right to think of roads and schools as capital assets, but 80% of investment occurs in the private sector. Unfortunately, North Carolina has maintained relatively high marginal tax rates on private capital formation. The problem isn't limited to domestic competition. Last year, I used both national and subnational tax rates on dividends, capital gains, and corporate income to compare North Carolina's effective tax rate on private investment to that of 23 industrialized nations in Europe and the Pacific Rim. We were at or near the bottom of the list by every calculation. That's one reason why North Carolina has failed to attract sufficient private investment to keep up with the demand for new jobs. While desperately throwing cash grants or targeted tax breaks at big companies might earn North Carolina a high score on rankings from the likes of Site Selection magazine, our lackluster economic performance over the past decade shows that this is woefully inadequate as a strategy for growth. The tax reform bill meets the challenge head-on. By broadening the base of both income and sales taxes, it frees up enough fiscal capacity to convert North Carolina's income tax into a flat tax set at 5.75% when fully implemented, down from today's top rate of 7.75%. Moreover, it reduces the double taxation of returns to corporate stock by more than halving North Carolina's corporate rate to 3%. Assuming certain revenue targets are met in the fourth and fifth years of the plan. Will the resulting revenue loss prove ruinous to the state's schools and infrastructure? Hardly. The net fiscal impact will reach $650 million in 2017-18 out of projected general fund revenue exceeding $24 billion. In other words, under tax reform, state revenue would grow 15.9% over the next 5 years instead of 18.6%. And that's a statistic projection. Even a modestly positive effect of tax reform on economic growth would make its fiscal impact even smaller. Moreover, the state still spends billions of dollars a year on consumption programs such as Medicaid, some of which ought to be redirected towards public investment anyway. There's more to do on tax reform. I'd like to see a future General Assembly make the tax code even more pro-investment by instituting tax-free savings accounts. differential rates for dividends and capital gains, and larger per-child tax credits to encourage family investment in human capital. But the 2013 tax bill is an excellent start that will give North Carolina's economy a welcome shot in the arm. This week's Small Business Profile is on Jerry's Art-O-Rama. Artistically speaking, the family fills a niche in retail supplies. This article is by Jason DeBrune and comes to you from Raleigh. Local artists agree that the Triangle has experienced a growth spurt in its art culture and art awareness over the past decade. The area has about 1,000 professional fine artists, art directors and animators, and more than 12,000 total artists, a category that includes architects, authors, producers, according to the National Endowment for the Arts, an independent federal agency in Washington, D.C. It's impacting the economy in a growing way as well. Direct expenditures by nonprofit arts and culture organizations and their audiences came to $143 million and supported 5,700 full-time equivalent jobs in 2010, about 1.5% of the total workforce, according to a study commissioned by Americans for the Arts, a nonprofit that works to advance the arts in America. The organization publishes economic impact studies of the arts on about 200 cities in the United States. The median impact on cities with populations similar to Raleigh was $78 million and supported 2,719 full-time equivalent jobs. The arts community is definitely growing. It's becoming more and more vibrant and rich every year, says Sarah Powers, executive director of Visual Art Exchange, a community of artists in Raleigh that exhibits the works of more than 600 artists each year. At the middle of this art activity sits Jerry's Art-O-Rama, one of the largest art supply stores in the nation and headquartered in Raleigh. Started in 1968 by Jerry Goldstein, the company now has a thriving online sales business, 16 retail stores and 2 franchise agreements, and 70,000 materials, and ships more than 1,000 packages every day. We want to strategically be where the artists are, says Michael Marchetta, director of marketing. That's why the geography of Jerry's retail stores is widespread and diverse. Outlets are in Austin, Texas, Fort Collins, Colorado, Miami, Tempe, Arizona, and West Palm Beach, Florida, among other cities. Goldstein worked for a toy store in Long Island, New York, and in 1965 took an interest in how local art teachers purchased art supplies. He was surprised to see how expensive the supplies were and convinced his boss to sell such supplies at a discount. The strategy worked and he opened his own store in 1968. Goldstein's 2 sons, Ira and David, started working at the store in their early teens and later took over as managing partners. Under their leadership, the company's mail-order operation has grown, and in 1994, Jerry's moved to a 28,000-foot facility in Raleigh. It now has an 80,000-square-foot facility in Henderson as well, which serves as a primary warehouse for online sales, a segment that comprises roughly two-thirds of the $50 million in total annual sales. Executives know that it's good business for the store to have more artists practicing their art. As such, the store contributes and participates in the art community. Powers says her group's SparkCon event, an annual showcase of the works of hundreds of local artists, is largely made possible because of the in-kind gifts from Jerry's Art-O-Rama. Without their support, we wouldn't be able to do it, says Powers. We are always trying to grow more artists and see more people who create art, says Marchetta. Even if it's just leisure, we try to promote it as a family activity. We try to make the artist the star. Executives have also tried to stand apart from competition by offering exclusive brands. Jerry's doesn't actually make supplies, but instead works out contracts with suppliers, then offers feedback to make those products better. Looking ahead, Marchetta says his company wants to continue to see more artists thrive in the greater Raleigh area. A thriving arts sector is not only good for business, but it's also good for the area's culture, he says. Jerry's Art-O-Rama is the company's name. They have more than 200 employees, and their top executives are David Goldstein, CEO, Ira Goldstein, President, and Bob Marcus is CFO. Their 2012 revenue was $50 million, and their website is www.jerrysartarama.com. This week's Washington Watch by Kent Hoover, who's the chief of the Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau, has several articles. There's a poll, Fannie and Freddie Need Axed. A new poll finds that most Americans favor phasing out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two mortgage lending giants that were taken over the U.S. government during the financial crisis. The survey of 1,200 likely voters was conducted by On Message Incorporated for the American Action Forum, a conservative organization headed by Republican economist Douglas Holtz Eakin. The poll included responses from conservative districts, Democratic-leaning districts, and swing districts. The poll found that 52% of voters favor phasing out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as opposed to 32% who oppose this step. On Message pollster Wes Anderson said most voters view the two companies with near-toxic levels of negativity. Also, SEC adopts a rule on offerings. Businesses raising money through private offerings will be able to advertise this opportunity to investors thanks to a rule change adopted by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The elimination of the advertising ban on a private offering should make it easier for startups and other businesses, including hedge funds and venture capitalists, to raise money. Only accredited investors will be eligible to invest in these businesses. But advertising these opportunities will enable businesses seeking capital to reach more of these investors. Here's a quick look at what's happening in the Triangle. Paperless tickets are coming to the Time Warner Theater. It may not look the same in a scrapbook, but it could help cut down on ticket scalping. When Keith Urban comes to the Time Warner Cable Music Pavilion on July 26th, thousands of fans will enter the gate not with a traditional ticket stub, but with a paperless ticket. Going paperless is a growing trend across the music industry. It's no surprise, then, that scalpers have tried to influence legislators to ban the ticketing method. Paperless helps ensure that a purchased ticket, which is linked to the credit card and ID of the holder, cannot be resold above the face value price. A nonprofit called Fans First Coalition has promoted such ticketing as safer for patrons. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.